You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, Christ is risen. We are in the beginning of May. This is May 3rd. You're listening to the Orthodox Nationalist, and of course this is Matthew Raphael Johnson. We're starting part two of what I hope to be only a two-part series on how oligarchy functions, what oligarchy really is, and most importantly, how your typical neoclassical or even Keynesian idea in terms of economics doesn't work. The elite make economic predictions that never come true. They say some of the most patently absurd things. We talked about some of that last week, and it's not mere... that, you know, it's not merely that they're being paid and controlled. That's a very just a tremendous amount of implicit power. It's not just that they're not really scholars in the true sense. But it's also that they're educated in a model that doesn't exist. You know, they're educated to deal with what we vaguely, and I'd hate this term because it's a neoclassical model. You know, classical to me is ancient Greece and Rome. Here, it's some variation of Adam Smith and his successors. Invisible hand, free market stuff. Which, by the way, has no connection to capitalism. Now, oligarchy has its own way of functioning, its own set of rules, and its own conception of itself that is very different from the hypothetical market economy, however imperfect it might be. This is a different economic system entirely. Now, notice I say oligarchy. And you'll have a lot of idiots out there who talk about strictly oligarchy as a political matter. And they're so bad off that they say that this is just ruled by a few. Well, that's not how Aristotle used the term. The few, in Aristotle's sense, are in the position they're in because they have money, often gained illegitimately. So it's not just any old few. It's ruled by the wealthy. And we make that distinction because Aristotle made it between oligarchy and aristocracy. As, you know, oligarchy is a perversion of aristocracy. So there is no difference, and actually this is a very important mark of the system itself, between politics and economics. Separating those two fields in 2023 is absurd. And the minimal reason is because capital has long since privatized the state. It's not too much of an exaggeration to say that major concentrations of capital, especially financial capital, completely dominates what the state does. Politicians, by and large, have only marginal power. That's why voting doesn't make any sense. Last week, we talked about, in some detail, about how this came about. Oligarchy, generally speaking, has to work in secret. They have to pretend that presidents run the country. Stupid comments like that. Public ignorance is in their interest. As I said last week, you know, Machiavelli's entire concept, and he's writing to the Italian oligarchs of his day. You know, the Republican idea is oligarchic. He knew that those people had no right to rule other than their money. Therefore, the only choice they had was to manipulate those around them. Everything's a zero-sum game. But then and now, oligarchy is an economic matter. It's also a political matter. The concept of political economy, that's why I have this in the title, reflects that. To think that there's this, you know, private capital and the public state confronting one another is laughable. It's probably been laughable throughout American history, but certainly laughable today. We talked about the legislative element, certain laws that had to be passed. Too complicated for the average person to even comprehend. The ideological, the media centralization, the collusion, groups like Bilderberg, the Great Reset, COVID, and of course one of the great watersheds, the 2007-2008 meltdown. Now we may or may not get to that because that's, I think it's a massive event that changed quite a bit. I mean, to some extent, the oligarchy came out into the open, was bailed out in the trillions of dollars, and nothing was done. There's no rebellion, no nothing. People just had their homes foreclosed on and quietly, you know, went and voted for somebody, as if those two things are even related. So we're not talking about markets. We can talk about capitalism. It's almost a redundancy to say capitalism is oligarchic. But what it is totalitarian. Therefore, it's revolutionary. It's an aggregation of itself across all sectors. And it really is run by a small group of people that's getting smaller. The role of COVID was to destroy the smaller businesses that were hanging on. It's never entirely going to disappear, but they made it impossible for small business to function. And we all know people who never went back in business again. Your classic oligarchy is the wealthy using the power that wealth creates to gain political influence. And of course, as we said last week, and I've used the word many times, the ability to charge rents. Usury is a subset of rent. Rent is non-productive profit. It's profit that someone can extract for non-economic reasons. But more above board things, like political lobbying, the political action committee, and the overall centralization of those institutions of influence, media, academia, education in general. And this is necessary both for oligarchy to establish itself as a cohesive institution, or the, you know, the master institution today, as well as to maintain itself. It's both a lesser cause and a greater result of the financial oligarchy coming to power. But that can't happen. None of this stuff can happen unless there is a relatively sharp change in public ideology. The revolution of the late 60s, early 70s, the association with the left and oligarchy is without question anymore. And in fact, the oligarchy controls the left, and that moderate, you know, Republican idiot libertarian movement who still, you know, thinks in terms of markets. The broader point is that markets don't exist, especially in an age of almost total globalization. The on, you know, monomaniacal focus on shareholder value. We talked about last week as well. There were so many elements here. The change in what counted as conservative and liberal, quote unquote, that was part of the story too, because as you know, those words changed radically. Citizens tend to accept a package deal when it comes to ideology. You know, conservatives have a checklist of things and they tend to accept the entire checklist. Whether or not it hangs together coherently is another matter. But one of the most bizarre aspects of this is how the revolutionary and anti-cultural free market ideology became associated with conservatism. It's really, it's a sleight of hand. the coming together of Marxism and late postmodern capitalism as essentially one body of doctrine. In the sense that their list of assumptions that they share is very, very long. 1945, social nationalism, not whatever you want to call it, was wiped off the map, just like monarchy was wiped off the map at the end of World War I. That means the entire world was split between Stalinism, Maoism on the one hand, and oligarchy on the other. That means, since the oligarchs were deep, you know, Western, you know, in London, Washington, helped build the Soviet Union. Remember, they were building up the Soviet military long before there was any invasion, the preemptive invasion. Nationalism, some form of social nationalism, is the main, if not the only enemy of this oligarchic, liberal, globalized order. Remember, the only time Marxism was ever seen as some kind of an enemy, even using Woodrow Wilson's own terms, if they began to behave like a Russian czar behaved in his addled mind, it became a problem. But more importantly, if it ever got large enough to cut the USA out of globally significant trade deals, then it became an opponent. And they're only at the fringes. Because even at the height of the Vietnam War, there were no sanctions on the USSR. Now, contrary to all the myths, you know, I've said before that in a condition of oligarchy, almost everything that the educated strata of the population believes in the West is a lie. Or at least a fantasy. Almost everything. Almost, you know, the main assumptions of your mainstream normie educated person is a story, a myth that they've been told to accept. And ultimately, that's the thesis here. You know, I think I ended last week by saying, you know, if you're an auto mechanic and you're absolutely convinced that an engine runs on cheese, or an engine runs with two ferrets running around in a circle making energy, no matter what, I mean, no matter, you know, you could be have this explained to you, it's not true. Internal combustion is not run by two ferrets in a wheel, and yet it's enforced. You have to believe that, and you're actually going working on engines with those assumptions. What product are you going to create? And that's a silly example, but it's the same. That's what happens when you use completely wrong assumptions to analyze something that, as far as they're concerned, might as well be on a different planet. The old myth, one of the myths of the regime, and the regime is a term I use for this oligarchic globalized order. Used to be the New World Order from George Bush the first, and the Great Reset coming out of the COVID nonsense. One of the myths is that the U.S. quote unquote supported anti-communist military dictators throughout the world, Latin America and Asia. Now, I don't know what supported means. They treated them no differently than anybody else. They supported the Soviet Union as much as they did anybody else. In my book on Latin American dictators, many of whom were very, very good men, far superior to the banana republics that they overthrew, you read the CIA cables and none of them liked military government. It may have been a temporary deal, but they were supposed to be overthrown sooner rather than later. And the cables are very clear. No one bothers to read them. You go from supporting the Soviet Union with trade and everything else, which occurred throughout the Cold War, to now the hysterical war cries, screaming, willing to go broke, willing to destroy the European economy for the sake of destroying Russia and China. In and of itself, it's proof that these are social nationalist states of one form or another. Not to mention the total lack of an anti-war movement in an era of non-stop, senseless, and no-win wars that even in the official formulation don't make any sense. All of these occur within oligarchy. And with our modern and postmodern assumptions, they can only occur within oligarchy. No one's going to vote this stuff into existence. Another sleight of hand, of course, that oligarchy requires is these now revolutionary conservatives who are supporting this mythic free market to attack labor unions. Because labor unions had to be pushed out of the way. That libertarian ideology, immigration, feminism, destroyed the trust that's required for a union to function. The left, being heavily financed by the oligarchs, the Rockefeller Foundation, etc., the working class in America was simply too white. So that meant there was no more. There was no countervailing power against the anti-union mentality. So somehow consumers and workers, despite being the same group of people, were ideologically reconstituted, schizophrenically, as enemies of one another. And all this stuff was created and enforced roughly at the same time. But these institutions are not taken seriously by most economic analysis. The market, so-called classical economic theory, leads to incoherence because the world that it believes underlies everything is not real. But even if it was real, it wouldn't function the way they think it does under globalization. Oligarchy needs shields, buffers, behind which they can rule. And ideology is central. So that means the centralization of media, education is equally so. And the punishment, sometimes violent punishment, of those who deviate. Left liberalism, neoliberalism, whatever the term is the official ideology of the regime. It's written into law, and no real deviation is permitted without severe consequences. So you have this weird fusion of the so-called identity politics of the new left with this corporatization, privatization mania of the libertarian so-called right. It's incoherent. And again, only a chimera, only the unnatural, usury-based, rent-based oligarchy could ever bring that into existence. The state was reimagined entirely. It's a means of social manipulation rather than the simple enforcer of contract. Myths like racism, systematic racism, were invented, quickly employed with no deviation possible to essentially nationalize corporate policy. This racism nonsense, sexism nonsense, means that anything you say in the workplace as a white male can destroy you. You have to watch everything you say, and no one else has to do that. That means you have federal law being brought to bear on everything that happens. Especially if you're working for a large firm. Now, hypothetically, these market economies are not supposed to have an official ideology, but oligarchies most certainly do. It's a requirement when you have a new concentrated ruling class, the regime, becomes coherent, becomes aware of itself as a regime, but certainly can't reveal itself blatantly. And as I've said 1,000 times, the line between public and private power was not just blurred, but erased. And yet, economists still assume that they're two different areas. So, in short, the ideology that was promoted and now enforced was designed to privatize and globalize everything, while at the same time, domestically, destroying all institutions that provide any kind of a firm, content-rich personal or communal identity. The family, the union, the ethnic group, the church, ethnic neighborhoods, and even now gender itself comes under attack. Now, would the free market bring that about? Of course not. Only force brings that about, and this is what oligarchs do. Talking about the state sometimes is strange because it's largely captured. You can't function without money, without credit, and lots of it. So if an oligarchy rules, they're the ones you have to go to. A sharp rise in crime that the regime brought about in the early 70s. The massive, sharp rise in psychological pathology were very much intended, and they eliminated any real force against globalization. And anyone bringing this up since roughly 2015, definitely since 2020, anyone defending these kind of institutions is banned from public life. So political debate is just really a process of agreeing with the regime. So the state was meant to be redirected, not shrunk. States never shrunk in size in our era. You know, previously, during the Great Depression, there was a concept of expertise, scientific management by the state in conjunction with labor and the managerial class could provide a growing economy managed by this coalition. The drive was to liberate the country from the boom-bust cycles that tormented capitalism throughout the 19th century. But once the corporate giants took over, the titans took over, and policy became global rather than national, it fell apart. Markets, to the extent they've existed at all, certainly internationally, were replaced by a media-driven invention of demand. People like Friedrich Hayek, who I've admired in certain areas, that kind of epistemology, the neoliberal epistemology, is based around the idea that free markets can synthesize the massive amount of information that an economy is going to create because of the simple complexity of millions and millions of people. The state couldn't do this, but all this oligarchy does is create a new form of the planned economy. Wants and needs, with the most, with the exception of the most basic needs, are dictated by media. Status matters more than anything else. The free play of demand, it doesn't exist. So the claim was that any effort by the state to understand, and the state is a legitimately public institution, to understand the signals market provides to manage production was equated with tyranny and communism. So the myth was promoted that oppression can only come from the state. When you have a situation where public and private aren't really meaningful terms anymore, that doesn't make any sense. There was one ruling class that captured both forms of power and brought it together into one regime. So the globalization of production, I mean, there's no globalization without oligarchy. I mean, they're able to capture the state to finance their and ensure their investments in whether it be in India and wherever else, solely for the reason of getting away from regulation and destroying the power of labor, taking advantage of foreigners who work for next to nothing. But globalization meant that most of America became poorer. Well, if consumption is going to be maintained, they have to now extend credit. At the same time, corporate jobs are being filled by those based on a quota. Being a protected individual, so-called protected individual in corporate America, means you really can't be fired except for some, you know, gross issues. The regime mobilized these groups, and globalization is internationalization, anti-racism, is all one and the same thing. But that kind of mobilization was designed to shut down those white males that dominated unions, blue-collar white males that dominated the unions, working in manufacturing and making solid wages. But that's come to an end. Free trade was equated with the lifestyle liberalism officially promoted by corporate policy and money. And somehow the myth was promoted that all of this will increase productivity and sustain economic growth. And it was just misdirection. Last 45 years, has been the gradual uncovering of that lie. I've been talking about this for 30 of those. You don't have broadly shared wealth. You don't have dynamic markets. We haven't seen any of this. It's an oligarchy driven by intensified rent extraction. Markets and private property aren't necessarily related because oligarchy is very iffy about private property. And productivity, since 1973, has been much slower than in the preceding century. Last week we discussed financialization and the diversion of resources into financial instruments, which are essentially debt and interest, and then using that debt and interest to leverage more debt to the point where you have the ultimate postmodern economic object, the derivative. You have a massive decline since at least 2008, but certainly before, post-80s. Entrepreneurship, measured by things like firm entry, the share of employment in young or smaller firms, declined sharply. And of course, at the same time, that also means that industry concentration is going to rise. Markups began to increase because in this kind of semi-monopoly point of view, they could charge what they please, especially if so much of consumption is female. Females dominate, according to the Harvard Business Review, about 80% of major purchases. And there, things like status is very important, especially for the younger ones. But no matter who you're talking about, with the exception of the younger women graduating college, and, it's going to get to the point where it's going to be 2/3 and 1/3 against men very soon. Real median income stagnated. While, of course, the share going to the regime, roughly the top 1% or 0.1% went up radically. So economic insecurity, despite the massive productive potential out there, economic insecurity became normal. Recently, there was a 40% of American households, and I'm sure it's higher than that, reported that they couldn't cover a $400 emergency expense, which shouldn't surprise anybody. And Americans, at least as far as any, it's hard to measure this stuff, but the American decline in life expectancy has been pretty sharp in the last 30 years. You know what happened to Russia under their Judaic oligarchy in the 90s. All of these are marks by which oligarchy functions. And covering it up and shutting down dissent is very important. It's the, you can't say that the emperor has no clothes. Because if one or two people start saying it, then other people are going to hear them. And that's why. Donald Trump was really a symbol for the regime. But they were terrified. He didn't need their money to run for office. Talk about him how you will. That wasn't supposed to happen. The man had been apolitical his whole life. And you see what the regime was able to bring to bear on him. But back to the point here. This all got started with me wondering why mainstream economists were such idiots. We could assume that they're intelligent people, but where the intelligence is directed is another matter. I'm always, it started by me wondering why these guys are wrong all the time. Is it projection? Are they just struggling to internalize that they're living in a dying society? That they're working for others that are often secret to them? So let me make it simple and list the assumptions, and this is a short list, that mainstream economists, public or otherwise, assume is true. The assumptions that they apply to any kind of economic analysis that they do. And the reason, of course, why their predictions are wrong. And these assumptions are sometimes not just wrong, but absurd. And therefore, whatever product they come up with, whatever analysis or prediction they come up with is going to be equally absurd. And there's more, but I have 19 here. This is what, and I think your typical boomer mentality too. Thank God I escaped the whole boomer thing because my parents were greatest generation, born in the 30s, and I was born in 71, so I skipped that, thank God. But the assumption people, and this is, average educated people too, non-professional economists, looking at society from that point of view, from the economic point of view, this is what they assume is true. They assume, number one, that firms don't dictate prices. They don't have any influence over prices. They have to respond to them. Number two, that the only two real economic entities that matter are consumers and companies, producers. And the state has a marginal role. Number three, as I've already said, politics and economics being separate areas of thinking, separate reality. Number four, competition. Competition is based entirely on the profit motive and the individual self-seeking of both consumers and producers. Five, the term labor means that it refers to the work required from human beings, not robots or anything else, to create value and a specific value demanded by consumers. Number six, that products are homogeneous. And what that means is that products of the same type are similar, but not identical. You know, you want a small, reliable car, Honda, Hyundai, Toyota. They're not identical, but they all do the same kind of thing. They all run on gas. And you could really, they could be interchanged and you wouldn't suffer too much. Number seven, and this is a big one, prices are basically derived from supply and demand. And again, as I said in number one, firms are in no position to create markets. They can only respond to them. And that implies, number eight, the invisible hand, in Adam Smith's sense, is functional. And it's a real thing. And because of that, markets will eventually reach equilibrium. And that's represented by price, by the prices. Number nine, a lot of this assumes that the number of companies in any market, any sector, is substantial, it's tolerably large, so no one or two or three can dominate it. Ten, that barriers to market entry are fairly low. You don't have to buy into an already existing infrastructure. If you want to get into the production of jumbo jets, you're going to have pretty high barriers to entry. You're going to need a fortune. 11, this is another big one. I don't know how anyone can believe this, but all contracting parties at any level have full information. They know enough about whatever it is that they're doing, whatever they're buying or signing, that they're making a rational choice motivated by financial gain. And it's a financial gain, if you're a company, in exchange for a benefit to consumers. 12, that buyers and sellers can find each other. They could link up, and the web's made that much easier. Number 13, that the state will intervene as a neutral party to remove any barriers to competition. 14, that rents don't exist, or at least they don't exist as systematic aspects of the system. 15, the legal system respects property rights and contract obligations and doesn't really determine their content, you know, except as provided for by law. And 16, a big one. Companies bear the full costs of their production. There's no externalities. And we talked about that as being one of the central marks of oligarchy, that companies externalize most of the cost of their production onto the society around them. 17, factors of production, land, labor, capital, whatever, they will be where they're needed to be, where they can best be employed. And that implies, to some extent, number 18, the transaction costs are minimal or non-existent. And finally, and this is a big one, there's no conspiratorial collusion among companies. In one form or another, maybe not in absolutely pure sense, but these are the assumptions that economists have when they go and observe economic phenomena. Now, there's assumptions even deeper than that, of course, that aren't really discussed, that are beyond economic science. And you notice that most of these are amenable to quantitative analysis, that is to say, numbers, and that economics is purely a quantitative field, which is a huge problem. If it's not reducible to a number, then it really doesn't exist. Now, that's mythical on so many levels. But to think that that exhausts economic science. Frankly, there's very little in the consumer market or the production market that's quantitative, even mostly quantitative. But these in practical terms serve as the foundation. Now, I'm not saying that economics doesn't deal with imperfect competition or market failures. Of course, that's a huge part of the field. But even when that's discussed, the implication is that, yes, the assumptions I just mentioned are they operate normally, but these market failures are anomalous. They're not systematic. That essentially the assumptions are true, but quite often they're vitiated by some form of corruption or distortion, shocks, whatever it might be. Market failure still implies the assumptions of the market. There's a book out, and I found this, even though it's from 2003, Ken Friedman's Myths of the Free Market. And he doesn't use a term very often, but he's dealing with a lot of the same things that we've dealt with in these 2 weeks. And he brings, you know, what we talked about, technological innovation, removing millions of blue-collar workers from the market. Roughly 7/8 of them are white male from the late 70s on. That's gotten worse because of outsourcing. It's led to the further destruction of a whole range of American workers. And connected to that immediately, of course, is downsizing. Downsizing is a lie that somehow if you hand over the company to one of these corporate raiders and they shed workers and shut down plants, you're going to get a leaner, more profitable, and ultimately an enterprise that serves the public better, which is absurd. Oligarchy, which the market system doesn't imply this, assume this, but in oligarchy, profits are a zero-sum game. But as far as this downsizing nonsense, Friedman says that since 1980, he uses the example of GE, General Electric cut its domestic workforce 40% while tripling revenue. Now, there's nothing, you know, this is, it's not, the market wouldn't tolerate this, but oligarchy would. In fact, from the early 80s to the early 2000s, your blue chip stock, your largest corporations, have, on average, taken together, enjoyed roughly a 300% increase in profits while destroying between 5 and 7 million jobs. And these are normally, you know, the solid, older, union-style jobs of the 50s and 60s. And he reports, too, that only 1 out of 10 workers laid off by downsizing subsequently found a job paying more than 80% of his previous salary. In other words, he took a giant pay cut, with very few exceptions. Attached to all that is a phrase that came out in the 1980s, the leveraged buyout. And it became a household term probably by the mid-80s. The financialization of the economy means the rule of debt, that the creditor-debtor relationship is the absolute foundation of social life. But it's a debt of very low quality, meaning that there's a high interest rate, but also very high risk. That in and of itself causes further downsizing. And as debt and debt repayment increases, more workers have to be removed. Last week we mentioned that when the economy is overwhelmingly dedicated to these derivatives, that economic growth, which is always being redefined officially, can include things like the so-called value generated by stock buyback programs. Or derivative trading, whatever. That takes money away from long-term projects, which include research and development and worker training. It's not an accident that the Great Reset said the whole concept of the career is over. Long-standing career jobs at a company are gone. Now it's just going to be the isolated individual getting a gig here and a gig there, doing peace work. No more benefits. That's all going to be placed on the taxpayer. That's a classic example of privatizing profits while externalizing costs. This is how oligarchy operates. All the things that I mentioned in a regular free market system, the way that we've been taught, that could never exist. That could certainly never be tolerated if it did. You've had something like $10 trillion in bailouts. And we're on the hook for it, by the way, leading to no protests whatsoever, at least none that mattered. Oh, there was, Occupy Wall Street, which made me laugh. But the long-term thinking, which is long gone, although I do think long-term exists in ideology, that they are thinking decades ahead in that regard. I mean, after all, debt does require at least a medium-term mentality, depending on when the bond matures. So it is an attempt to control the future, which is something that no one has a right to do. Time is not yours. You don't create it. Therefore, it isn't yours. You don't create your life either. But the long term, research and development, etc., worker training, worker education, that's what develops new products and manufacturing methods. They're on the back burner today. It's a huge diversion of cash from actual production, including R&D and other related fields, to these financial instruments. Another way of putting that is that the future, Western countries, is being mortgaged to pay for short-term profits of today for a tiny group of people. That's a form of asset stripping. Asset stripping, we saw this in the 90s, and after that in Ukraine, the 90s in Russia. There was no attempt to rebuild infrastructure. There was no attempt to revitalize production. It was a super short-term mentality where they simply sold off everything and hid the income somewhere, usually outside of the country. But asset stripping in a broader sense exists everywhere. Since new production is a result of research and development, but the short-term financialized mentality wants cash in hand now, and remember, without taking that into consideration, any economic analysis is going to be nonsense. If you want cash in hand, you're not going to be adding to assets in terms of actual productive capital. That's the point. So since new production is a result of different versions of research and development, but that is not being financed because, cash in hand now, assets are at a maximum being maintained in their present state. Now, I probably, I've spent a lot of time talking about BlackRock, the largest company that's ever existed, monopoly capital, tens of trillions of dollars in holdings. This is where oligarchs have their assets managed. BlackRock and Vanguard. But these firms are motivated by the same short-term profit motive as anyone else. And this is how they choose their executives. Now, BlackRock has said that liberal ideology is official, and they're going to finance only those companies that are explicitly leftist, of course. Even if it costs them, it doesn't matter. Like Friedman says, back in 2003, talking about similar phenomenon, the time frame defining performance. You're rewarding executives based on performance, but what does that mean? The time frame. How do we know that he's performing well? That's been shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, maybe even 12 months. In other words, if you don't produce substantial cash flow in 12 months, you're gone. So that means the focus on the short term is both the cause and the consequence of oligarchy, and certainly, that means inflated salaries at the top. And we talked about that last week. I mean, look, people buying stock, you don't care why the stock price goes up or down. And certainly if it goes up, you're not going to ask any questions. But it's going up in certain cases because of bubbles. Everything from asset stripping, layoffs, buybacks, externalizing costs, manipulating the numbers, capturing a state agency, destroying unions. This is how prices and so-called stock values are inflated. And none of it derives from actual production. It has to therefore derive entirely from debt. But the old leverage buyout idea, again, markets have nothing to do with any of it. If a CEO is compensated entirely based on short-term profit considerations, that means he automatically has an incentive to offer the firm to someone with a lot of cash on hand. But of course, you know, corporate raiders, no real connection to the industry. They don't care. So you can have a more or less profitable company that can be offered at a very high premium on the present stock value, which means the premium becomes pure profit. And the premium exists because of, you know, it's a profitable, solid company. But when that happens, not only will the CEO claim massive growth in earnings, he's personally enriched. Let me quote Friedman here specifically. And this is, you know, a 20-year-old book, but it's still extremely important. Talking about this concept, he says, despite the catchy slogan, making a company leaner and meaner doesn't necessarily make it more efficient. Wall Street Journal, July 7, 1995, in a survey of large corporations that had downsized between 89 and 94, reported that only half of them achieved an increase in operating profits and only one-third experienced improved productivity. Despite a general increase in both corporate profitability and productivity. In fact, 86% suffered a decline in employee morale. They may have been leaner, they may have been meaner, but they were hardly more productive. For one thing, morale can affect productivity. In addition, revenues often decline in tandem with expenses. Then you talk about employee morale. What he's really talking about is investing in employees. Training, education. That's a long-term commitment. And the way that oligarchy, especially the financialized oligarchy, works now, there are no long-term commitments. But none of this affected the dominant ideology or these very massive high-level salaries. These salaries from the elite came at the expense of the middle classes, blue and white collar together. And of course, no one can say that, let's say even half of this is true. You can't claim that markets allocate capital in the most efficient manner. You can say that none of this has anything to do with markets at all. But if you want to claim that the market functions in one way or another, you can't at the same time say that the last four decades have shown that markets allocate assets in an efficient way. Oligarchy is a default mechanism. It's what capitalism is. There's never a time in history where firms, companies, enterprises are ever equal. Now, today, 2023, it's been stretched to almost comic level. Now, when I talk about ideology, it's important not merely in politics or religion, but also advertising. Another mark of oligarchy is heavy psychological manipulation via advertising. You guys have seen it 1,000 times over. Since 2020, it's rare you find a white male in an ad. And it's comic when you realize that the product being advertised is very much a white product, like certain times certain types of high-level video games. Black kids in the hood are not buying these. And yet, that's who they have in these ads. That means it's not about selling anything. It's about their ideological commitment, their brand building. So you'll have someone who believes in the free market very naively, and he'll assume, as we've already said, that consumption is driven by getting the most value for available money. You have a certain amount of money to spend. You want to get the most value for that money. Well, that's really a dodge, because I don't know what value is. In postmodern oligarchy, value doesn't really exist. It's only perceived value. Perceived value and value that actually matters, they're two very different things. Brands invest in psychological manipulation through advertising. Billions and billions of dollars a month. It's doing something. And it's usually very sophisticated. You know, you have someone, you know, a has-been from yesteryear, like Shaq, Shaquille O'Neal, who for some reason still matters, promoting cough drops. Well, the assumption isn't that, oh my God, he was a great basketball player. I better go get Hall's cough drops. That's stupid. That is not what they're doing. It's a long-term. I said the one thing that they do long-term is ideology, association. Between everything that a black basketball player symbolizes to your product. And it takes a while for that to sink in. Why spend millions for celebrity endorsers? It's not even something as simple as associating a celebrity with a product. It's far more symbolic than that. Brands. Status. This in the market mentality, it can't exist. Specific commodities, brand names, or even ingredients have a status attached to them. And you will spend a fortune that you don't have to buy them because your peer group says otherwise. It's not an exaggeration, or if it is, only slightly so, to argue that oligarchy functions entirely on perception and deception rather than anything real. That's why it relies so heavily on advertisements in the broad sense and building a brand. The brand itself is loaded with symbolic value. These logos and everything else, these aren't just accidentally discovered. Now, the free market, just like liberal democracy, and the two go together. They're separate fields, but that separation is artificial. They're based on pretty much the same assumptions. The master assumption, and I gave you that list before, one that kept coming up is that consumers, as well as voters, are rational. And rational being defined as your financial self-interest. You're calculating machines. And nothing else really matters that much. But that doesn't explain then why advertising budgets and these stupid political campaigns are spending ridiculous amounts of money. A political campaign or an advertisement for a product is not about convincing you rationally. It's approaching you subconsciously. They provide artificial reasons to want something, confusing wants and needs. Why does Budweiser continue to advertise? Everyone knows that they exist. That's not the point. It's an alteration in consciousness that matters. Consumers and voters are the same people, of course. If they're rational and the system is based on their reason, choosing something that serves their interests, then why advertising at all? Why hire Shaquille O'Neal, of all people? Or Kevin Hart, who apparently is in every other ad? Why the obsession with image and these kind of symbolic associations, spending a huge amount of money on it? But the fact is that the consuming public is non-rational. Therefore, this massive assumption of both liberal democracy and the free market is non-existent. You can't analyze consumer behavior based on self-interest. My God, look at the debt. $50 trillion. That was a few years ago in consumer debt. You know, the market, we talk about the free market, Adam Smith, his perfect competition model, the assumptions we just listed for the most part, it's hypothetical. It doesn't really exist. And yet somehow they assume this is the foundation of how goods and factors of production would ever circulate. Remember, the Smithian idea rests on smallish companies functioning with almost perfect information, serving a consumer base that also has almost perfect information. It's kind of the master assumption of the market model. Now, the farming communities of many years ago, certainly something like that existed, but that's not what we're talking about here. Markets moved to oligarchy quickly, especially given the Darwinian assumptions that were added to this in the middle of the 19th century. Oligarchy promises more money and power to those running certain firms than simply, you know, fair competition. You want to compete eventually to become an oligarch. Ideology, psychology, political influence, among many other things, work together to create the rule of a handful of companies and their pet state, not only in a sector, but across sectors. We know what COVID did. Walmart was open, but the stores, smaller stores selling the same things, were shut down. So even if the hypothetical model had truth to it, it doesn't matter. Especially since Darwin became the central figure in both colonialism and capitalism. Darwinism, in its simplistic, you know, simple guise, justifies the coming to existence of dominant mega firms. But I can't stress enough, offshoring, downsizing, everything destroys tens of millions of jobs with no replacements. The dominant blue-collar force in decades, which is a white male earlier, had to be kept in his place. Addicted to cheap beer, porn, and white guilt. But even high-level white-collar jobs now are being shifted abroad. Since the 80s, this has been overwhelmingly an attack on white labor. And he has been replaced with massive levels of immigration, both to the U.S. and the EU, physically replaced by those who are willing to work for much less. Only an oligarchy can want this and bring this about, and only an oligarchy can justify it. And that's the reason for the violently, and I mean violently, anti-white position, media, academia, etc. And you know, one of my favorite writers is Paul Craig Roberts. I'm going to quote him. This goes back to 2009. He was the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under Ronald Reagan, and has become one of us. He says this, and he's talking about the replacement idea. Not content with moving Americans' jobs abroad, corporations want to fill the jobs remaining in America with foreigners on work visas. Business organizations allege shortages of engineers, scientists, and even nurses. Business organizations have successfully used public relations firms and bought and paid for economic studies to convince policymakers that American business cannot function without H-1B visas that permit the importation of indentured employees from abroad who are paid much less than going U.S. salaries. The so-called shortage is, in fact, a replacement of American employees with foreign ones, with the soon-to-be-discharged American employee first required to train his replacement. It is amazing to see free market economists rush to the defense of the H-1B visa. The visas are nothing but a subsidy to U.S. companies at the expense of U.S. citizens. And of course, for the most part, he means white male citizens. Nothing like that could possibly come into existence under a normal market system. Now that this is not an anomaly to the market. The market doesn't exist. Only in a regime composed of a handful of capitalists can any of this come about, not just be permitted, but be enforced and ignored by everyone with a stake in the system, even called a benefit to the world. We're already at 58 minutes. And what the last thing I wanted to do is a 2008 meltdown. Now, I've dealt with that years ago. I dealt with it at the time. And the reason that a lot of people concerned with researching oligarchy want to talk about it, because it was the first publicly admitted blatant proof of the existence of oligarchy, and that markets, in the sense we normally use the term, don't exist. That they have no relevance. It's an entirely new system with an entirely new set of assumptions, and the old variables are absurd. the 2008 crisis was a watershed. And bailouts were discussed freely, using huge numbers. There's a book called All the Devils Are Here, The Hidden History of the Financial Crisis, came out in 2010. And they say that, you know, we're talking about real estate, mortgage, and related fields. They say the entire industry was built on a foundation of fraud. And they're talking about the policy innovations that went into creating the concept of making mortgages a value that can be traded, bought, sold like any other security. Innovations that we talked about last week that go back to the 1970s, at least late 1970s. Real estate here is just the most blatant example. The financialization of mortgages. So clearly we've already discussed that. Mortgages have value based on the solvency of those entering into them, which assumes that the economy is going to continue to grow, since the profit revolves around these homeowners paying on time. Then, of course, the legislative aspect, where the regime withdrew Glass-Steagall, and then the so-called market permitted to run, the real estate market permitted to run according to market forces. The point there is, they're assuming that the free market assumptions are real. They weren't. So overthrowing Glass-Steagall and allowing this so-called free competition doesn't make sense anymore. Now that act, Glass-Steagall, was part of the banking reform of 1933, which placed pretty tight restrictions on private banks, separating functionally and institutionally investment in commercial banking. This is a classic example of believing that the normal market assumptions of competition still exist and therefore will allow banks to do whatever they please and compete, and it'll turn out great in the end. It doesn't exist, of course. Nothing makes any sense if you're a free marketer about the entire mortgage-backed security scam or any kind of derivative like that. It's power, not markets. Let me quote them quickly here. They had the imprimatur of the ratings agencies, whose profits depended on stamping these complex bets with a AAA rating. They massively increased leverage in the system. They were made possible by the invention of the credit derivative, the most glittering innovation in finance. And the raw material? The debt upon which everything else was built. Mortgages, quite often poorly underwritten subprime mortgages. Credit rating agencies, I have a whole paper on them, are another mark of oligarchy. They decide what's a good bet and what isn't, not the market. Deregulation didn't permit market forces to develop, but that's the assumption behind deregulation. All it did was give already powerful people a means of manipulating the desire for homeownership. Status is important here. And it was a result of turning mortgages into a retail industry. The homeowner shouldn't be let off the hook. People who had no right to be homeowners. They don't let the average middle-class citizen off the hook. The American citizen, the normie, late boomer, is as greedy and irrational as Goldman Sachs. They took out risky loans because they sought the status that comes with homeownership. Middle-class Americans were leveraging everything as if the feeding frenzy would never stop. So the mentality was the same, but the average American doesn't have any power. Sellers of mortgages became a high-growth industry. Debt retail developed into an oligarchy in and of itself. These consultants took huge fees, including from people who had no good reason to buy a house, no business buying a house. Rating agencies were working for mortgage companies. Ratings were deliberately falsified. And it was more rational for firms like AIG to lie about their rating for short-term profit than to tell the truth for long-term viability. The market has nothing to do with any of this, but deregulation assumed that it would bring about competition and hence the public good. That is not what happened. Without long-term rationality, even the best market structure is going to fall apart. Psychology was ignored, but it shouldn't be. Markets as an ideology only work when the field is not already dominated by an elite. So, I mean, they got rid of collateral. They invented the collateralized debt obligation. All of this assumes continual growth. Artificially low Federal Reserve rates. A lot of the same people are involved in this. And even when they were bundling mortgages, they were recorded off the books. The debt can't be sustained over time. It's a short-term mentality where profit rather than production are the standard of success. And that has everything to do with the deindustrialization of America, where money is being diverted from actual production to things like government bonds, if the dollar is strong. That's what the bubble. You can't, markets don't really create bubbles. Only oligarchs who are able to manipulate people into thinking and acting in a certain way can create them. They have no stake in the country as a whole. They're going to be wealthy no matter what happens. Well, I think I've made my point. I like mentioning 2008 crisis because in repealing the regulations on banks, the assumption was, and all the arguments on Capitol Hill said the same thing, competition will bring out the best in these firms, assuming that there's this even market playing field. It's a ridiculous assumption, and the 2008 meltdown is a classic example of what happens when you refuse to comprehend the rule of oligarchy. There are no markets in any traditional sense of the term. It's just power. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.